From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Around the world today, bullet trains are zipping people from city to city at speeds pushing 270 miles per hour. Now, the closest thing we have to that in the U.S. is the Acela, which trundles along its New York-Boston leg at an average whopping 66 miles per hour. Well, California was supposed to build the nation's first truly high-speed rail line. The dream was San Francisco to Los Angeles, but that's been scaled way back by Governor Gavin Newsom. And yesterday, the Trump administration demanded California return a $2.5 billion grant and is canceling close to another $1 billion marked for the project. So this hour on Point, why can't the U.S. get high-speed rail right? And you can join us. Where are you on the high-speed train debate in the United States? Do you think we need it between major American cities? Do you want it? Is high-speed rail a modern, fast, and clean alternative to airline travel and slower trains and, yes, cars? Or are they just boondoggles that we can't afford? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Well, we'll begin today with Rod Diridon Sr. He is known in California as the father of modern transit service in Silicon Valley. He even has a train station named after him in San Jose. He's chair emeritus of both the California High-Speed Rail Authority and the U.S. High-Speed Rail Association, and a founder of the American Public Transportation Association's High-Speed Intercity Rail Committee and National High-Speed Rail Corridors Association. He joins us today from Palo Alto, California. Rod Diridon, welcome to On Point.
Nice to be with you, Meghna.
And by the way, it seems as if you are one of the grandfathers or fathers of America's push for high-speed rail here. So first of all, just give me your initial impression or reaction to the fact that Governor Gavin Newsom in California, he didn't kill that project for sure, but he scaled it way back. It looks like it's going to be 171 miles now of high-speed rail between Merced and Bakersfield and not the, you know, roughly 380 or 400 miles it was supposed to be between San Francisco and L.A. So are you still happy with that?
No, of course, we're not happy with that. But I think the governor is saying now very firmly that he was misinterpreted and that he does intend to finish the project as it was envisioned from Bakersfield and Merced through the Mount Hamilton range into Gilroy and San Jose and Silicon Valley and San Francisco. It's just a matter of phasing that a little more extensively than we had hoped.
Okay. So, but we don't yet know when or how much it would cost. I mean, I think one of the reasons why he wanted to sort of, as far as I understand, put a little few, some constraints on it right now is because he was saying it was going to cost him too much, some $77 billion.
Well, that's the price tag. You don't get anything for free. And in America, the cost of construction is higher than the rest of the world. We're more congested. Our environmental laws are strong. We want them to be strong, but because of that, it takes a lot longer to prepare a project for construction, and our people are paid more, and we want that. So we're not going to change those things. So it's a matter now of coming up with the money to build the projects. Mm-hmm. You know, we can't be told that we don't have the money. We're the richest country. California is the richest state and the richest country in the world. And there are 12 other high-speed rail projects going in the world. So let's figure out a way to do it.
Yeah. Well, let's listen to a little bit more of what Governor Newsom said in his State of the State address in California last week. And Rod Diridon, as you mentioned, the governor says he still backs high-speed rail construction. But that the thing that caught everyone's attention is he says right now it's taking too long and costing too much.
You know, I have nothing but respect for Governor Brown and Governor Schwarzenegger's vision. I share it. And there's no doubt that our state's economy and quality of life depend on improving transportation. But let's be real. The current project, as planned, would cost too much and respectfully take too long. There's been too little oversight and not enough transparency.
It's Governor Gavin Newsom of California last week. Rod Diridon, you know, we're going to talk this hour about what the challenges are to getting true high-speed rail anywhere in the United States. But I just have to ask you, I mean, it's 2019. Isn't it kind of a shame that after decades of high-speed rail being developed elsewhere around the world, we still can't even really get these projects off the ground in a meaningful way in the United States. This country, in my view, is the best positioned of any nation in the world to benefit from high-speed rail projects. Why can't we get it done?
Magna, you are so right. We are the worst polluter in terms of greenhouse gas pollution in the world. We're double the per capita pollution of any other country in the world. And part of it is because we're so addicted to the use of petroleum as our primary source of energy. The rest of the world has begun that shift radically to electric power, and high-speed rail is the best example of that shift. Moving people from typically short-hop airlines up to the 600-800-mile distance over to electrically powered, steel-on-wheel, very efficient high-speed rail. There are 12 different high-speed rail systems going now in 12 different countries in the world. Why is it that we can't do it? Well, there's opposition from the oil companies. There's opposition from those who don't want to spend a dime for anything. And we just have to break through that now. And it's a matter of being determined enough and not accepting the word of the naysayers and instead figuring out a way to do it.
But, I mean, the naysayers, even though Governor Newsom wouldn't say he's one of the naysayers, he's essentially just given them more fodder now by saying the process hasn't been transparent enough and it costs too much. So, I mean, if a Democratic governor of the state of California can't even, like, throw his unbridled enthusiasm behind a high-speed rail project, what hope does it have anywhere in this country?
Well, I want to stress that we've had five governors now support the high-speed rail system in California, two Republicans and three Democrats. And so it's not a partisan issue in our state. We're here to try to figure out a way to create the most efficient transportation system, both in terms of operations and in terms of energy. And all of those governors have agreed that high-speed rail is the right thing to do. It's a matter of figuring out a way to do it most effectively. And what Governor Newsom is saying is that he's concerned about the delays, and we all are, that have plagued the current project. And the cost has increased. Delay in a big project like that is equivalent to cost increases because of the inflation of construction costs. And so we just have to move ahead now, maybe scale the project back a bit in terms of some of the frills that were being developed. Every town can't have the system go under the town in a tunnel. We just have to realize that. And so it's a matter now of building the system as well as we can. And we've got examples all over the world of how to do it right.
Okay. But, you know, no one's calling for us to be China and have a centralized government that just can just seize land and build maglev trains wherever it wants. I'm not hearing a lot of political enthusiasm to adopt European models and heavily subsidize major rail transportation projects through taxpayer money. So how do we get there, Rod?
I think that we are beginning to see support for subsidizing rail construction. Not operations. Remember, high-speed rail makes money on operations in almost every one of its examples around the world. There are a few that require subsidy, but most of them, once they're operating, are making enough money from the fare box to cover operating and maintenance costs. So it's really a matter of finding the money to build it. And there are new sources of funds coming online as a reaction to the crisis that climate change presents to the world. Carbon taxes, cap and trade, and other kinds of things like that are generating substantial amounts of funding that in California are being put in part to the construction of high-speed rail.
Mm. Okay, so Rod Dyrdon, stand by here for just a moment because I want to bring in another view here. Joining us now from Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, is Noel Perry, transport economist and founder of the market research and consulting business Transport Futures. And Noel Perry also happens to come from a long family tradition of careers in the railway business, and he himself worked for companies such as Cummins Engines Company and CSX Transportation as well. So, Noel Perry, welcome to you.
Thank you, Meghna. It's nice to be here.
It's great to have you. So let me just ask you, do you think in 2019 that we should even be having this conversation about whether or not the U.S. should build high-speed rail? Or is the very need for rail in this country sort of antiquated? And are there better ways to move people around?
Well, you asked two questions. Obviously, we need to debate the future of transportation in this country. We're on the cusp of a revolution in technology. And it's very important that we consider all the alternatives as carefully as we can. So the first answer, obviously, is we need to debate it. The second answer, and I would put it this way, you started the conversation by saying, how come the U.S. has not gotten high-speed rail right?
Mm-hmm.
And I would state very firmly that it has gotten it right. It is a extraordinarily expensive way to move people 300 to 500 miles. And we already have a very relatively cheap way to do it that's even faster. And so the only argument that you can make that supports this idea is that it is environmentally profoundly superior to the airplane as a technology. And if we simply look at the fuel it takes to move a airplane compared to the fuel that it takes to move a train, because the train allows all the cars to draft behind the locomotive, it uses less fuel.
Yeah.
So that's half the answer. And when we come back, I'll give you the rest if you'd like.
I would love to hear that. So Noel Perry and Rod Duridon, stand by for just a moment. I am asking this hour why the U.S. can't get high-speed rail right or really even off the ground in a meaningful way. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com. Code POD.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. And that is some sound of the Eurostar train, the high-speed rail service that connects London to Paris and to Belgium as well. It's been in service for 26 years. And yes, that's the train that goes underneath the English Channel. And we are talking about high-speed rail service in the United States today and why the U.S. can't get it right, or if in 2019 we should even bother. I'm joined today by Rod Duridon. He is with us from Palo Alto, California. He's chair emeritus of both the California High-Speed Rail Authority and the U.S. High-Speed Rail Association as well. And Noel Perry joins us from Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. He's a transport economist and founder of the market research and consulting firm Transport Futures. And Noel Perry, before the break there, you were talking about reasons why high-speed rail might be superior, or the few reasons why you think. You talked about environmental reasons, but you wanted to give us another one.
Well, let's finish the environmental piece, and that is, yes, on an operating basis, trains are more fuel efficient than airplanes if they're full. And we know the airplanes are full. We don't know that the trains will be full. They are in some routes, but not all. And the second most important thing is that in order to build these things, you have to use a army of petroleum-powered equipment. And so the emissions that come from building a 400-mile system from San Francisco to L.A. or the 3,000 or 4,000 miles that people would like to do in this country would go a long way towards erasing any advantage that these trains have environmentally. And that's the hard from the emissions piece. And the other there are two more things we need to point out. First of them is that elsewhere in the world, cities are far denser and far more adapted to this technology than in, the United States. That's the first thing. And so we don't – there's – by my count, there's only two corridors that could justify such trains, Chicago to New York and Boston to Washington. And in and even there, there are great difficulties because you need very dense cities with great transit. Now, New York has that, but most of the rest of the country does not have sufficient density to fill the trains without building huge parking lots.
Wait, can I just jump in here? I mean, why just those two corridors? And Rod Dyrdon, I'm going to get back to you here in a second, but Noel Perry, why just those two corridors? Why not San Francisco, Los Angeles, San Francisco, Seattle? Look, there's even one under consideration between Houston and Dallas. We've got big cities in the United States that are within a couple of hundred miles of each other, with the same distances between London and Paris or Tokyo and Kyoto. So I don't understand, why there's so few possibilities in your mind.
Well, here's my evaluation. There are three characteristics that are required. First off, the cities have to be big. And certainly San Francisco and L.A. are big. However, they're not nearly as big as the European examples you used. That's the first thing. The second thing, they have to be 300 to 500 miles apart. And in this case, L.A. to San Francisco is. The third thing is they have to be very dense downtown. And neither of those examples, L.A. or San Francisco, have anywhere near the density that Paris and L.A. have. I mean, and London have. Nor do they have the transit that supplies people to the stations.
Okay, so Rod Dyrdon, let me bring you back in, into the conversation. Just what's your response to Noel Perry saying the fundamental setup of American urban centers does not lend itself to high-speed rail?
Well, I guess if you have no vision of the future, then you may want to buy into some of those arguments. But I have a vision that America is going to continue to be a great place and grow. And we want it to grow in a manner more similar to the European communities rather than urban sprawl, which has a tendency to be the way we've grown in America in the past, because we've been car-bound and depend on the automobile, which takes us out into the suburbs. Now, let me address the points that Mr. Perry brought up. First of all, the cost. The cost of construction for high-speed rail is significant, but so was the cost of constructing the airport systems around the United States. Once those systems are built, though, the cost of operating high-speed trains is much less per passenger mile than the airlines. And the cost of the pollution, both in terms of the petroleum cost and the cost to society of that pollution, is much less, much, much less per passenger mile. The second point that he makes is that the density is different in the United States. Well, that's just not true. I don't know how often he's visited San Francisco, but San Francisco downtown is as dense a community as any you're going to find in the world, and as fine a transportation system as most you're going to find in the world. And L.A. is rapidly catching up with the rest of the world with a huge investment in population-centering activities in terms of construction in the downtown area and a far-reaching mass transportation system that will be second to none in the world. And Silicon Valley around San Jose San Jose, by the way, is a very big area, 2 million people now in the population center. And they're building an outstanding feeder and distribution system based on commuter rail, metro rail, light rail, buses and bicycles and so on. So those areas are going to have, they currently have, and are going to have all of the amenities to support a high-speed rail system that any other place in the world has. Mm-hmm. And by building the system ahead of time, there's a tendency to focus that growth around the transit programs rather than have the growth sprawl out into the farmlands and the last viewshed and watershed lands.
Right. So, Noel Perry, I want to give you a chance to respond to what Rod Diridon's saying. He's kind of given a point-by-point rebuttal of all your reasons why you don't think high-speed rail is worth the investment.
Well, this is not the place to get into the details of urban density. I have a degree in city planning, and in a different setting, I would rebut with facts everything that Rod has said. Let's just get back to the fundamentals. The United States now has a deficit, cumulative federal deficit of $22 trillion. In order to build a system like that, we're going to have to invest somewhere between $700 billion and $1 trillion to do this. Where does that money come from? And I'll tell you where it's going to come from. And here is the issue. I am 72 on both Social Security and Medicare. In the next 10 years, we're going to have to make extremely difficult choices as to what the government can fund and what it can't, because our ability to borrow infinitely is in its last decade. When that comes, the politicians, I hope, will look at these questions and say, do I want to cut Medicare and Medicaid in order to provide a little faster transportation between LA and San Francisco? Or do I want to fund my Social Security and my Medicare? And of course, even if we have a national system, it'll only serve 10 or 12 states. What about the other states who will be asked to fund this $700 billion to $1 trillion? So it's a fiscal question. It's a very simple political fiscal question. And my position is that there are opportunity costs to that money, and those opportunity costs are way better than saving some fuel between L.A. and San Francisco.
So let me jump in here for a second, because
I don't agree with that.
Yeah,
by the way,
Rod, I'm going to come back ahead to you in a minute, but Noel Perry, you're basically asking a question of choices that the nation makes on where and how to borrow and spend, and this $1 trillion price tag. We have made choices to borrow and spend that much on things like wars in the Middle East, on things like tax cuts for the next 10 years. So the question of whether or not we can, I think, is kind of moot, because we can and we do. But the question is, should we on high-speed rail?
Yes,
and you're saying that we shouldn't? I mean, Rod Diridon, what's your response to that?
Well, I think it's terribly short. By the way, Mr. Perry, I'm 80 years old. And I've been through an awful lot. I'm getting Social Security also. And I don't see those services being impacted by this kind of an investment at all, except on a positive basis, by allowing our economy to work more effectively. And I think your estimation of $70 billion to $1 trillion for a high-speed rail system is ridiculously high. We're talking now about focusing on those areas where you're between 400, 600, 700, 800 miles between population centers. And that really is only about 4 or 5 quarters now in the United States. And all of those are under study. And in fact, the Brightline system down in Florida is in operation now. It isn't true high-speed rail, but it's good, and it's a step in the right direction. The system in Chicago to St. Louis is being built at a higher speed, not high speed. Acela is a step in the right direction with 150-mile-an-hour service in one element of the corridor. And by the way, their average now, Magna, is up to 81 miles an hour. So, and they've captured the airline market. between Boston and Washington, D.C.
But 81 miles still seems to be rather plodding.
It's a step in the right direction, but it's not a very big step. But the point is that we're going to have to figure out a way to compete with the rest of the world. And the country that gets people to work and product to the market most efficiently wins that competition. We've been very lucky to have the facilities left over from the investments of the late 1800s and early 1900s that we've been able to use up to the 1950s. Now we're skating on that investment, and we have to continue to be competitive, or we're not going to be the dominant economic factor in the world.
Well,
if we're not, then by golly, we're not going to collect the taxes to pay your Social Security payments.
Yeah. You know what, Noel Perry, I know you probably wanted to respond to what Rod Dyrdon's just saying, but I do want to go to the phones here because we have a lot of folks who want to share their view or question about high-speed rail in the United States. So let's go to Richard, who's calling from Miami, Florida. Richard, you're on the air. What do you think? Are you for high-speed rail or not?
Yes, I am. And you got to remember, we didn't have an interstate system until we had a president who said, I think we should build an interstate system. And that probably put us far ahead of other countries in our efficiency in business to cause us to be a leader in the world. Why is our discussion about building a wall and not about building a high-speed rail system? I could be in Miami to Orlando, Tampa within an hour, or after a little bit less than an hour, a little more than an hour, and I've got to drive 5 hours, get on a plane or get on a train and ride for 5 hours. And I don't understand it. Questions I have is two. One is, can we use the present rail system that we have today? The second one is, are the airline lobbyists fighting this and doesn't want to do it? We voted for a high-speed rail system and won in Florida in 2005, and Jeb Bush killed that. He took that will of the people away, and we would have had a rail system. You have to start somewhere. And it shouldn't be just localized, Boston to D.C. It should be a grand plan to connect all the cities, like the interstate system.
So, Richard, I'm going to take it back from you there, and thank you so much for your call. Let us start with Richard's basic but important question for people who, you know, aren't train enthusiasts. And Noel Perry, he asked, can we use our existing rail system? I'm guessing the answer is a hard no.
Well, it's a mainly hard no, but there is a caveat that Rod pointed out. We can speed up existing rail services. Now, as an economist and a taxpayer, I wouldn't subsidize that, but we can, and we have. The Acela has a top speed of about 120 miles an hour. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there are ways to do those things. They can be done for relatively little investment, and that's a different question. The question that we're talking about here with two to 300 mile an hour railroads, they have to be completely separate, because you can't mix a train that's going at 270 miles an hour past a train that's going 50 miles an hour.
Right. So, Rod Dyrdon.
Can't mix them.
Yeah. So Rod Dyrdon, I mean, this is actually a really practical problem that's an important part of the story in the United States here. So, if we're having to build, if we want to achieve this real dream of high speed rail, and we're having to build entirely new systems of just the track itself, it runs into issues of land ownership and cost and construction. And are those, realistically, are those insurmountable in this day and age?
Oh, absolutely not. They're just construction projects. And by the way, you can mix the high-speed rail programs in the areas coming into cities where you can run melded service. They do it all over the world. You can't mix them on the high-speed sections when you get out of the cities and are between the major communities, when you're going 200 to 200. And by the way, the fastest high-speed train system in the world now, in terms of a train system, is 235 miles an hour, and that's the Chinese system. There is a little maglev element in Shanghai that goes near 300 miles an hour, but it's just a little carnival ride. It's
a scary carnival ride. It's 444 kilometers an hour and banks really hard on a turn, and you feel that you're going very fast.
Yeah, that hasn't been adopted as a as a real mode of transportation outside of that little short section in Shanghai. The rest of the systems are 235 miles an hour is the fastest system, the Chinese system. Ours is being developed for 220 miles an hour in California, and it is going to be operating in dual service with regular trains in what's called the bookends between San Francisco and San Jose and Gilroy, San Francisco and Silicon Valley, and the L.A. area from Burbank Airport down through L.A. Union Station to Anaheim.
But, Rod, can I just jump in here for a second? We have less than a minute to go before a break. I want you to justify that calling that whole system then a high-speed rail, because if only sort of the middle section of it goes fast and you're back on slower rail or even forms of public transit, it's not the sort of downtown-to-downtown dream at all.
Well, actually, it is, because the high-speed trains will go downtown to downtown. They just will operate a little bit slower when they get near the towns.
Okay.
And they do that for safety and for noise. When high-speed train gets going 200 miles an hour, there's a little air noise.
At some unspecified time in the future, though, we'll have that downtown to downtown.
So sooner than later.
Okay. So Rod Dyrdon and Noel Perry, stand by for just a second. Time to take another quick break. We are talking about the dreams and realities of constructing high-speed rail in the United States. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about fast trains and hard realities in the United States, or in other words, why can't the U.S. get high-speed rail right? And in 2019, should we even bother? Now, this conversation was inspired by the fact that this month, California Governor Gavin Newsom temporarily, or at least for now, scaled back what would have been the United States' first truly high-speed rail train project. He did so in his State of the State address. And here's a moment from that address where Governor Newsom, addressing folks who wanted to outright cancel the project, telling them why that would make no economic sense. And we also have today's news, or this week's news, by the way, of the White House and the Trump administration wanting to revoke some funding for this California project. But here's Governor Newsom earlier this month.
And for those of you, I know you're out there, that just want to throw away this whole project, sort of give up on this whole endeavor, I just offer you this. Abandoning the high-speed rail entirely means we will have wasted billions and billions of dollars with nothing but broken promises, partially fulfilled commitments, and lawsuits to show for it. And with all due respect, I have no interest in sending back $3.5 billion of federal funding that was allocated to this project to President Donald Trump.
It's Gavin Newsom, the governor of California, earlier this month. And, of course, just this week, the Trump administration decided it's going to ask for that money back. We've got a lot of comments coming in online. Bill Kenter says high-speed rails are costly projects. The interstate is still faster after these are built. Gerald F. Nord says there are practical reasons for the difficulty, but there's also cultural resistance to high-speed rail. J.L. Boole says airlines, auto manufacturers, and oil companies see rail transportation as competition they will lobby against, and they have powerful lobbyists. David Carter Burns says this is shameful. High-speed rail would bring us into the 21st century. There's no vision. Someone calling themselves Third Way Forward says, I'm all for mass transit, high-speed rail, etc., but it has to be affordable by regular people. If we can't do it right in the Boston to New York corridor, it's folly to think we can do it in the middle of the country where distances are more formidable. Let's go to Robin, who's calling from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Robin, you're on the air.
Hi, Magna.
Hello to you. What's your thought?
Hi, I'm an urban planner here in Wisconsin, and I just wanted to sort of basically say that development follows access. We spent over $500 billion in today's dollars just constructing the interstate system. And after we did that, all the development in the United States basically followed that, thus justifying the cost and investment we spent on that transportation system. And that doesn't include the maintenance and the road and oil subsidies that we put into the road since then. It's often the biggest single thing in our local budgets and whatnot. And U.S. densities in certain corridors are close to Europe and Japan. And rail is the most efficient in the space, energy, and time kind of way to transport around. And when we go to automated vehicles, it's a good way to basically link in with it. So that's all.
Well, thank you so much for your call. Noel Perry, if I may ask, I'm not sure if that was you I heard sighing in in disappointment or what. But let me ask you, so since the caller there just mentioned autonomous vehicles, that makes my mind actually move forward to a bigger question about high-speed rail in general in the United States, given that we're in 2019. So, you know, even if we undertook these projects now, it would take time to build them. Is there the possibility that, technologically speaking, high-speed rail is no longer even the right or best idea for future transportation? That, you know, 30, 40, 50 years ago it was, but now we ought to be thinking about entirely different forms of transportation to be investing in?
The answer is yes. We don't know what that new technology is. What we do know is that the pace of technical change is so rapid right now in transportation that something new is going to come along. And we have some very practical examples of this choice that you talked about. In the late 1700s and early 1800s, canals were the rage, and they were much better than the previous alternative for moving freight. And we built a huge system in Europe and in the United States, and in 20 years later, it was obsolete because a railroad was invented. Same thing happened with interurban trolley cars in the early 20th century. So one of the huge risks of putting down the kind of money we're talking about here is that by the time they're done, they'll be obsolete.
Mm. Rod Dyrdek? Noel Perry. Didn't mean to interrupt you there, but I wanted to get...
Well, one more point.
Okay, sure.
Excuse me for insisting, but there's been a lot of talk on this show about why we spent the money for the interstate highway system, mm-hmm. and we did. Just remember that in 1950, a superhighway was profoundly superior to what it replaced. This idea is only slightly superior to what it replaces, if you believe the claims of the proponents.
I see. Okay. That's
the difference in the investment issue.
Okay. Interesting point. So, Rod Dyrdek, respond to that right there, because I think Noel Perry is making a provocative and important observation here, that the difference now is trains may not actually be that much better in the big picture.
Well, that's not true. That's why the rest of the world is going to high-speed rail. And in developing new techniques relating to high-speed rail that make it more efficient and allow it to go faster all the time. And it is profoundly better than what we're operating now in terms of, short-hop airlines. The short-hop airlines' pollution on a seat-mile basis, energy use, and costs are phenomenal. And they're embedded because the airports are already there. But the cost is very significant, both in terms of actual cost and social cost of that pollution. So the rest of the world has really begun to look in a new direction, and that's with a different kind of high-speed rail than has been observed in the past. And I don't see anything emerging on the horizon that would even come near the efficiency and the cost savings and energy savings and pollution savings of a good high-speed rail system. And if there is a moment, I'd like to describe an example of how it would be used most effectively and how it will be used in California.
Go ahead.
The Silicon Valley is the headquarters of Apple and Google and Hewlett-Packard and Facebook and all of those largest tech companies in the world. It has many more people coming into the valley every day than live there. 200,000, almost 200,000 people commute back and forth across the mountains between Silicon Valley and the Central Valley, where the high-speed rail will go. Right now, they're 2.5-3 hours per direction to get from the North Central Valley to Silicon Valley. The high-speed rail, and by the way, they're all driving cars, creating tremendous pollution at great cost, both social cost to their families and cost to themselves in terms of dollars, in terms of that car. The high-speed rail system, on the other hand, will be less than 1 hour, instead of 2.5 to 3 hours per direction, less than 1 hour from the biggest city in the Central Valley, Fresno, and to Silicon Valley, where a feeder and distribution system has been built and is being expanded to allow people to move from the high-speed rail system directly to their employment opportunities.
Okay, Rod, can I just jump in here for a second? Because I might be missing something here, but you keep talking about sort of a completed high-speed rail network along that whole sort of the backbone in California. But when is that going to happen? Because I that's the part I don't see. I don't see a date or a plan to get those trains, the high-speed trains, all the way up into Silicon Valley.
The Central Valley portion, which gathers people in the fastest growing area in the United States now, in the Central Valley, from Bakersfield to Fresno to Merced, is under construction now and will be done and in operation by 2022. The portion between San Francisco, San Jose, and supposedly Gilroy is under construction right now and will be in operation by 2022. Now, all we need is the connection between Silicon Valley and over the Pacheco Pass to Central Valley, and you've got a network. Hmm. You've got a 500, 400, 300 miles network, 500 mile network that connects the fastest growing area with the heaviest concentration of high tech industry in the world.
Okay.
And why not do that?
Yeah. Well, let's go back to the phones here. Let's go to Richard, who's calling from Norfolk, Virginia. Richard, you're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call. I think we need to use the word investment. I become a rather despondent when I come back to the U.S. after visiting countries of Germany and Denmark, where they have wonderful train service. 2 to minute in areas where they're not great density. Yes, they may be subsidized, but it has afforded them an opportunity to improve the environment, their economy, and tourism. I just don't understand why we can't invest in our infrastructure.
Well, Richard, thank you for your call. Noel Perry, would you like to respond to him?
Yeah, I'll respond to two things. A very important point is Germany is a different place than the United States in terms of its urban geography. We are far less dense than Germany is, with far greater distances. That's the first piece. The second piece is that there is the assumption that those subsidies are wise use of public money, and I challenge that. So that's the first answer. The second answer is with respect to Rod's example of Silicon Valley. Now, we're talking about the most clever technological innovators in the world. And if they have a problem attracting workers who have to drive 2.5 hours one direction or another, why don't they go to a virtual organization? I am a consultant with a national reach, and I live in a small town in central Pennsylvania. I don't need a big city. I use a computer. Why doesn't Silicon Valley say, stay, if you want to live in Merced, work there and I'll contact you over the internet?
Hmm. You know,
that can be done for no investment.
Yeah,
let me answer that because the Silicon Valley folks have tried virtual commuting, and it reduces the creativity of these brilliant people that they're recruiting from around the world to come to their employment opportunities and create the next generation of whatever technology is going to be coming onto the market. They want those people together so they have the synergy. And they've found this through actual trying of virtual commuting. And it doesn't work as well as having people together.
So I want to get back to the issue of rail and high-speed rail here for a second, because we could talk about sort of the best ways to work in the 21st century for sure. But Noah Perry, you just said that you would challenge the public assumption in Europe and places like Germany that public dollars spent on rail and high-speed rail is a good is a good way to spend that money. Your case for that. I mean, I think lots of people in Germany and Europe would say they completely disagree. What else should they be spending it on?
Social programs. There is an opportunity cost to that money.
But they are already spending it on social programs, and they would consider rail transit as a form of a social good.
Okay. Let's use Italy as an example. Italy is about to go bankrupt. And so there is an opportunity cost to further investment in subsidized transportation. That's my simple, position here. And we're arguing, of course, about Europe, where such things make the most sense. In the United States, the urban geography is very, very different.
Okay. Let's go back to the phone. Let's go to Mike, who's calling from Detroit, Michigan. Mike, you're on the air.
Hi. How's everybody doing today?
Pretty great, Mike. Go ahead.
Can you hear me all right? Yep. All right. Awesome. I wanted to say I'm a construction worker in the Air Force and an engineering student currently. And one of the things I've noticed a lot throughout life growing up is the lack in the past several decades of amazing projects or construction jobs or advancements we've made through civil engineering, mechanical engineering, anything like that in our society today. And it almost seems like we've been stuck in a rut ever since the ending of the Apollo program. It's not to say that we haven't made great strides, but, I mean, when you look at the things of the past, you just see that the workers back then, the designers, the inventors, everyone had, I guess, more or less optimism and ambition. And nowadays, we don't really have much of that. If I can use a couple examples real fast.
Well, actually, Rod, I'm sorry. Mike, I'm so sorry about this because we don't have enough time to go through your examples, but thank you for your call. Rod Diridon and Noel Perry, and Rod, I'll start with you. We've got just like a minute and a half left here.
I'd love to springboard off of his comment by saying what you need in this process is vision. And vision for the United States means that we're going to densify. Our population is going to increase. And we need to have that population increase focused around train station rather than sprawling out into the community as it has when we've been so dependent on the automobile. And that's what trains do, high-speed trains being the intercity connector and local trains, whether they be metro, commuter trains, light rail, but electrically powered, providing feeder and distribution service in a metropolitan area. That's what's occurring now in California, in our major cities in California. And we're trying to do it right, but we have to have high-speed rail as the inter-city interconnect rather than having to depend on noisy, dirty, short-hop airlines.
Well, Noel Perry, we've got 30 seconds left here. Just want to give you a chance for a last thought for this hour.
Sure. And I'll give you the topic for another program. I challenge what Rod said about the densification of America. I think that technology is making us less dense. And so, therefore, the need for such transportation, I think, is being reduced rather than increased.
Interesting. Well, Noel Perry, transport economist and founder of the market research and consulting firm Transport Futures, thank you so very much for joining us today.
You're welcome. Thank you. It's nice to be here.
And Rod Diridon, Chair Emeritus of the California High-Speed Rail Authority and the U.S. High-Speed Rail Association, past chair of the Bay Area Metropolitan Transportation Commission. And I have to say, the first person I think we've had on Point who has a train station named after him. Rod Diridon, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Megha.
Well, folks, keep your comments and thoughts coming about what you see as the future, if any future, for high-speed rail in America. Go to onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook at OnPoint Radio. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.